Good morning, everyone. I want to welcome you to our online service this morning. Thanks for tuning in, joining with us as we conclude our sermon series, Because I Said So. Trusting God when His ways are not our ways. We're taking a look through the Ten Commandments, and we are on commandment number 10, the final one, which in Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, I'll read it for you. It says this: "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." And again, of course, if we take a literal translation of scripture, we would say to ourselves, I'm in the clear. I haven't coveted my neighbor's ox in many, many years. But of course, there's so much more to it in the context. Covetousness is the focus of this particular commandment. And the sin of covetousness has massive implications in our world. It has a lot of negative consequences as a result of it going unchecked in our hearts in this life. To covet, the definition of it, is to have an inordinate desire for wealth or possessions or another person's possessions. So, of course, exactly what the commandment suggests here: desiring your neighbor's house, desiring your neighbor's husband or wife, desiring any of your neighbor's possessions moves into the realm of covetousness. But covetousness is a tricky sin. Like many of these commandments that we talked about, it's very subtle. It's very hard to pinpoint. It can be very difficult for us to understand exactly what it is as it is happening in our hearts and in our minds. It's a tricky sin. When it comes down to it, there's nothing wrong with having a desire for nice things or to live a really great life. We want to own nice things. We want to become successful in life and to make lots of money. And in and of itself, there's no sin in having that desire. We want to live in a nice house. We want to drive a nice car. We want to marry a handsome man or a beautiful woman. In and of themselves, those desires are not defined as sin. It's the inordinate desire. It's when we take a very natural desire to enjoy good things, which we all have and is what motivates us in a lot of ways to become or to do or to accomplish. And so there's nothing, of course, wrong with that. But it's when it becomes an inordinate desire, when it becomes a desire that is born out of jealousy for what another person has achieved or for what another person has. However, we wouldn't know the good life that we were missing out on if it wasn't for having someone else to compare our lives to. Therefore, at the heart of covetousness is this issue of comparison. We see the success of those around us and we crave what it is that they have and what it is that they have accomplished. We step foot in our neighbor's house, and all of a sudden, our own house is no longer adequate, or our neighbor buys a brand new car, and all of a sudden, we have to keep up with the Joneses because we crave to enjoy all the new features and all the wonderful aspects of their lives in our life. And this problem, I think, has been exacerbated over the course of the last decade, of course, in due to the fact of social media. And I know this point has been made ad nauseum, but it's a reality that we just have to face, and I would be remiss not to mention it the onset of this particular sermon. Never has there been a time in which we have been more aware of what others have and what we do not have than with the advent of social media and the kind of comparison that takes place in social media. Because you get on the social media while you're at work and your friend is posting about their amazing vacation in the tropics, right? Or you're at home alone on a Friday night and your friends are out having an amazing adventure or going to a sporting event or on a date with an amazing person. And we get the impression that everybody else is having the time of their lives and we're missing out. And that is magnified because everybody who's doing something tends to be the ones that post on social media. Everybody who's lame and at home and broke and struggling in their lives tend to kind of leave that to themselves. And so we post the best of our lives, the highlights, and then we don't post when we're doing our average ordinary routine in life. And so the feeling is that everybody's out there living their best life. I'm stuck at home. And comparison has never been so easy. Comparison has never been such a difficult temptation for us to deal with as it is now. So let's just state that fact. I know that it's said over and over and over again, and sometimes it goes in one ear out the other. Oh yeah, social media is the problem. It's everything. It's what's wrong with the world today. Maybe that's overstating things, and nevertheless, it is a factor. It is a huge factor in our lives today. So there's something odd about this commandment, especially when we take in consideration the commandments that have come before this 10th commandment. First off, there are two major things that this commandment is placing off limits. One is the house of your neighbor and the spouse of your neighbor, and all the possessions that are contained within the house, of course, as well. But what's odd is that we've already established in the previous commandments, in particular the 7th commandment, which was not to commit adultery, the 8th commandment, which was not to steal. And so we recognize that these two commandments have already been outlawed. So why is it that we need a 10th commandment to address these two issues that have already been addressed in previous commandments? Just a reiteration of what we have already heard. In fact, the only real difference between this commandment and the other commandments, forbidding adultery and forbidding stealing, is this word covet. Now we have this word covet attached to it. Now, because we've been so shaped by the way of Jesus and the way he taught us to think about things, we know how serious the condition of our heart is in the matters of these commandments. So we know it's not just the act that God is seeking to forbid us of. We know that it's the condition of our hearts that leads to oftentimes that act. However, the Israelites were not so privy to the wisdom of Jesus. They were still groping around in the dark. And I think this is precisely why a lot of people, they have a difficult time understanding the Old Testament. They see it as archaic. They see it as just rules. They see it as black and white and not really relevant. It could feel like just a list of rules. But when we take a deeper look, we find that the wisdom of Jesus has always been in the revelation of the scriptures. It's there in the Old Testament as well. We just need to dig for it to gain further insight and understanding on what God is really desiring to convey. Remember what Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount. He said, it's not enough to not commit adultery. He said, even if a person lusts in their heart for another man or another woman, they have already committed the act of adultery. And so the condition of the heart, the lust of the heart, is what really mattered. And all that Jesus was doing in his analysis of that law was combining the 7th commandment not to commit adultery with this 10th commandment not to covet, not to desire another person's spouse. So he was combining the commandment not to commit the act with the commandment not to desire the act. And that was the true wisdom of Jesus' teaching. Covetousness is therefore about desire. It's about the condition of our heart. And this commandment wraps up all the other commandments wonderfully by helping us understand what it is that is going to help us to live and act in a way that is in accordance with God's law. If you want to keep yourself from doing these things that are contrary to the way that God has called you to live, then pay attention to the condition of your heart. Pay attention to your desires. And that's what this word covetousness is really all about. Covetousness is a matter of keeping your desires in check. Let's look at a biblical story that outlines this exactly. This idea of keeping your desires in check. It's found in Genesis chapter 4, beginning in verse 2. Again, as we talked about last week in the law of first mention, which is so important for theology, understanding theological concepts, we take a look at the story in the scriptures where first mention of desire is found. This first mention of covetousness is found as one person is comparing themselves to another, and tragedy is the result. Genesis chapter 4, verse 2. Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. These are the two sons of Adam and Eve, Abel being the youngest, Cain being the oldest. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. Cain worked in the fields, grew vegetables, fruits. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions, from some of the firstborn of his flock. That seems to be the determining factor that Abel brought the firstborn. He brought the best, you could say. Seems to be the indication here. And that Cain just offered, some of the fruits. So the Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Now pay attention to some of these emotions that are being described here. Cain becomes very angry. His face is downcast. And then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you so angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right," and this is a key instruction, "sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now Cain said to his brother, "Let's go out to the field." While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother and killed him. First act of murder ever recorded in human history. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." One of the first things that we learn from this story about desire and about covetousness is the relationship between the two. Disappointment is the mother of covetousness. Disappointment is the mother of a lot of things, but it's the mother of covetousness. The beginning of a lot of things that ail us as human beings comes out of disappointment. And I think that maybe chief among those things is covetousness. Cain's sacrifice is not accepted, but rather than focusing on what has gone wrong with his approach, rather than focusing on what has gone wrong between his relationship with God and why God has not acknowledged him, all that Cain can do is become fixated upon his brother's relationship and his brother's success. And that comparison in the midst of his disappointment is what leads to Cain's covetousness and ultimately his violence and the violent death of his brother. So the first thing that we want to learn about covetousness is this. If we want to disarm the power of covetousness in our lives, which I think is something that we should all shoot for, we must stop focusing on what others are doing. That's the first thing. We must stop focusing on what others are doing. You and I, we are unique creations of God. Our talents, our past experiences, our abilities, our personalities, our giftings, they are our own. Our lives are an adventure in many ways of our own choosing. God has purposes and God has plans, but he gives us the freedom to choose the direction that we will go in life. You are not called to live the life that your neighbor is going to live, and for better or for worse. And that's good news. It's great news. You will have your own challenges, your own victories, your own defeats, and everything in between. And we have to learn to appreciate our own adventure for what it is, on its own merits. That does not mean that we should settle. That means that we should immerse ourselves in what God is calling us to do, the purposes and plans that He has in store for each and every one of us as a unique creation. And let's not obsess with mimicking another person's journey. You and I, we have our own life to live. Don't fixate, don't focus upon what others are up to. One of my favorite interactions between Jesus and his disciples comes following Jesus' resurrection in John chapter 21. And Jesus is having breakfast with Peter. He's engaging with him. He's restoring our relationship with him. And he explains to Peter some difficult things that he's going to have to go through in life. And he's calling Peter to follow him once again, but he's acknowledging that the road that he is asking him to go down is filled with all sorts of challenges and even may require ultimate sacrifice in his life. And Peter's response to that is for him to immediately turn to John and say, okay, well, that's my journey. What about him? What about John's journey? What does it look like? His immediate response is then to compare. Okay, well, what do you have in store for John? Is there something sweeter behind door number two for John? And Jesus' response to Peter is this: if I want him to remain alive until I return, what's that to you? You must follow me. And I love that response where Jesus redirects Peter to the heart of the matter. And he says, you must follow me. That's the choice I'm giving you. You either follow me or you walk away from the destiny that I have for your life. What is the life that others will live to you? You must follow Jesus. Keep your eyes on your own path, on your own journey, and leave others to their path and their journey. You must follow Jesus. And so that's the first point. If we want to disarm the power of covetousness in our lives, we must stop focusing on what others are doing. The second thing is this: if we want to disarm the power of covetousness in our lives, we must not focus only on ourselves. And I realize that that seems like I'm discounting what I just said. But consider this. Cain, as a result of being rejected, is downcast, the scriptures say. Literally, his head is down. He allows his failure to dominate his thoughts, to shape his identity. And it doesn't say explicitly in the passage from Genesis chapter 4, but I think that what Cain was going through is the emotions of feeling like a complete loser. And men in particular, I think, are very challenged by these emotions. We become fixated upon our failures. Our failures affect us in inordinate ways. We allow our identity to be shaped by our feelings of inadequacy, and it leads to anger, it leads to resentment, and ultimately rage. I coach junior high basketball, something I enjoy a great deal. And one of the reasons I enjoy it is I love how easy it is to read the emotions of junior high athletes, junior high kids in general. They tend to be very exuberant in their highs and very dramatic in their lows. And so you can read them like a book based on their emotional reactions to things. And I've found that some of the most competitive players, usually they're the best players, but they also struggle greatly with being fixated upon their own failures. And it helps them in their highs in the sense that they can celebrate themselves and appreciate their own skills and abilities and drive confidence. But then there's also a very ugly side to that when they don't perform well, when they make a turnover, when they miss a shot, all of a sudden the head goes down and they sink to very low levels of confidence as a result of things not going their way. And they are the ones that tend to be a little bit more volatile, a little bit more difficult to manage. And it's fist bumps and chest pumps when things go well, it's a different story when they lose. Head goes down, all of a sudden, confidence takes a dive, and they struggle. And the reason I love coaching kids is it's a lot easier to see what's going on the surface. But with adults, it's a very different story. With adults, a lot of those things are being internalized. We're going through a very internal process. It's something we bury on the inside. We stifle our emotions, we hide them away, and we suffer oftentimes the responsibility of defeat and dealing with that in silence. Maybe a failed business, maybe a failed relationship, maybe a failed investment, whatever failure you want to fill in the blank there. When we fail, many of us struggle with internalizing that pain and internalizing those feelings of inadequacy and defeat and helplessness. And our disappointment becomes magnified when we fixate upon ourselves and our problems. We become obsessed with our failure. We berate ourselves for not doing more and not being more. And as God said to Cain, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. God said that to Cain in the midst of his disappointment because he knew that in the midst of his disappointment, that was going to be his point of greatest temptation. To internalize that pain, to sink into levels of depression as a result of his disappointment and his failure, and to just stew in it. Right? That's the temptation. And he knew he had to lift Cain's spirit and his countenance, or at least call him to that and warn him of the decision that he would make to just stay in it and to just stew in it and just allow it to accumulate feelings of resentment and guilt and anger and frustration, and for him to lash out the way that, of course, he did. But how do we master our sin? How do we master it in the midst of those moments of disappointment, like what Cain was going through? Well, that leads us to the third point that I'd like to make this morning. If we want to disarm covetousness, we must turn away from what others are doing. We must not fixate upon ourselves and focus on ourselves, internalize everything. We must turn our eyes to Jesus. That's the solution. That's the key. There's an old hymn with these lyrics. It says, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full into his glorious face, and the things on earth will go strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Seeing Jesus brings with it a transcendence that is very important for us to experience in times in which our tendency is to keep our head down, kind of focus in on ourselves, or even to focus in on what others are doing or what's going on in another person's life. When the hymn says, the things of this earth will grow strangely dim, it's strange because these things should matter to us. But there are natural human emotions. They affect our lives. Many of the things that disappoint us, they affect us personally. And so it's strange that the affection and love that we have for Jesus in a moment of worship, which this hymn is describing, strangely can satisfy every other longing and desire that we have in our hearts. And that's a powerful thing. It's a powerful revelation. Now, some people would criticize this and say, well, just because your life is miserable doesn't mean that you could just be looking forward to heaven, right? And just put your head in the sand and just forget everything that's going horribly wrong in your life. And the point is not to be out of touch with reality here. It's to be so present with the things that really matter that we become focused in on what is most important in the moments in which we are facing disappointment, the crucial moments in our lives. I recently went to visit a friend who was in the hospital and dying. And in fact, I did their funeral a few months back. And so they knew, they sensed that this was the end. And that could be a very troubling, very difficult thing to go through. I don't think any of us can imagine what that's like until we reach that point in our lives. And I recognize that this person was able to keep their focus off of the problem of being in the hospital, of their body not responding to the treatment that they were receiving, of why things were turning out the way that they were. They could have been incredibly frustrated with the hospital staff. They could have been frustrated with the situation. They could have been frustrated that maybe others had failed them or let them down. This person could have been venting and frustrated and upset, which would be a very natural emotion and something that we could probably even forgive and say, you know, it's easy to understand why they could have been this way. But they weren't. This person that I visited in the hospital was focused on relationships, was focused not on the pain that they